It is a great pleasure to welcome to Best Ideas 2022, Pat Retzer. He is President and Chief Investment Officer at Retzer Capital Management. Pat spent the first several years of his career in public accounting and then developing tax planning software, all while earning a master's in taxation. He moved into investment management in 1987, joining Heartland Advisors, manager of the Heartland family of mutual funds in Milwaukee, Wisconsin. While at Heartland, he was portfolio manager of the Heartland U.S. Government Securities Fund. He started and managed the Heartland Wisconsin Tax-Free Fund, was co-manager of the Heartland Value Plus Fund, and managed private accounts. In 2000, Pat left Heartland to start Retzer Capital Management and the Retzer Fund One. Pat believes his 35 plus years of experience in both fixed income and equity management, as well as his background as a CPA and tax specialist, give him a unique perspective on the financial markets. And Pat, we have greatly enjoyed your presentations in the past. I know our members have benefited from them, and I look forward to your remarks today as well. Please go ahead.
Well, thank you, John. It's great to be back again. The title of my presentation today is Second Bite of the Apple, and I'm going to talk about Kirkland's, symbol KIRK, which when I put this together a couple days ago was $14.93 a share. Our standard disclaimer is on that first page. People can read that at their leisure. Kirkland's is essentially a specialty retailer of home decor and furniture. As of December 1st of 2021, they had 369 stores in 35 states. Several years ago, they brought in a new CEO, highly respected retail veteran Steve Woody Woodward, and we'll talk about him a little bit later. But led by him, the company has undergone an impressive transformation that included improving the merchandise mix, implementing direct sourcing, closing underperforming stores, emphasizing omnichannel capabilities, negotiating lower occupancy costs, and streamlining infrastructure to reduce operating expenses. Thus far, they've already seen a substantial improvement in operating margins, EBITDA, and cash generation, enabling them just in the last calendar year to buy back over 11% of their outstanding shares. In the third quarter last year, however, they did have a slight earnings miss. It was reported December 2nd, and they also adjusted the fourth quarter guidance. Most of this was due to supply chain issues and dramatically higher freight costs, and this adjustment caused the stock to fall below $15 from a 52-week high of $34.45. Despite the adjustments, they still expect year-over-year earnings growth of approximately 50% for fiscal 2021 and to end the year with $50 to $60 million in cash. On the third quarter conference call, the CFO said, and I quote, adjusted earnings per share was 51 cents versus an expected 58 cents compared to 66 cents in the prior year. If we normalize the year-over-year freight impact within the quarter, our adjusted EPS would have increased by 23 cents or 35% compared to the prior year period. So So we've all heard about the skyrocketing freight costs and the supply chain challenges and the cost increases companies are incurring about that or regarding that. And in Kirkland's case in this quarter, it caused Q3 earnings to fall 15 cents. And without higher freight, they would have increased by 38 cents. So a 38 cent a share or about 80% swing there. Because of that, like I said, the stock got punished more than cut in half from the 52-week high, which puts it currently at about 40% of revenue and 5x EBITDA, while competitors sell at 2 to 4x those valuations. So here we are in early 2022, and the stock has started to crawl higher. But with tax loss selling now over, the market appearing to shift, especially today, to focus on value and away from growth. And a lot of the talking heads are talking about the performance being in small cap value this coming year. As Kirkland gets over their supply chain and freight challenges and progress through the transformation, I believe the stock is going to prove to have substantial upside. So the second bite of the apple is when COVID hit, this, as well as a lot of other retailers, got severely punished. COVID, in many ways, actually helped them. One way is it put two of their competitors out of business, not into reorganization, but into liquidation. And it also created an environment where they were able to renegotiate a lot of their rents and get substantial concessions, leading to dramatically lower operating costs. So that's the opportunity in a nutshell. If we can just page through the investor presentation, starting with page 3, I'd like to point some things out that highlight in more detail some of the things I just mentioned. This is the mission statement. Again, Steve Woodward, and he prefers to be called Woody. He's transforming the company into a high-performance specialty home furnishing retailer, offering value, quality, and design with a differentiated omni-channel experience for our customers. So you can see he's dramatically transforming their merchandise mix, both in terms of quality and in the type of offerings, and that should lead to not only higher revenue and earnings, but also substantially larger average customer purchases and so forth. We can go to the next page. This shows when Steve came into the company, they were down in the lower right-hand corner of the value versus quality and modern versus traditional grid. And they think currently they're about halfway through the transformation of moving not only up the value chain to higher quality products, but also having a more modern mix of offerings. On page 8, so this shows they want to solidify Kirkland's as a casual lifestyle brand with highly curated merchandise and evolve into home furnishings assortment comparable with Pottery Barn and Crate and Barrel, but at a value price point and adapt a methodical evolution of merchandise with opening price points familiar to the current customer base while adding higher quality and design options. We could move to the next page. This shows again what they're doing in more detail and where they believe they are. The assortment, evolution, quality, and design. When Steve came in 2018, he thought about 10% of their product mix was in the better category. And, you know, granted, this is kind of vague, but I think it gets the message across. And 90% was in good. And as they've moved up the quality ladder, they think 6% of their product offering qualifies as the best available merchandise, 32% better merchandise, and 62% good. And their goal in 4 years is to have 20% in the best, 30% in good, and 50% in better. And again, still at a lower price point than competitors. The other thing they're doing, not only do they have a lot more control over the product mix, but to save cost, is they've started doing direct sourcing. And when in 2020, they had virtually no direct sourcing. Now they're about 40% direct. And in 4 years, their goal is to be at 70%. We could go to page 13, John. You know, obviously the customer is key to this. So they've enhanced their loyalty program. They reintroduced it in October of 2020, just 14 months ago. And last year already, Newsweek magazine recognized it as the number one loyalty program in the home decor sector. And they did that just 11 months ago in February of 2021. 75% of the sales are made by loyalty customers. So having an effective program is a big deal. And they've had 6 million customers active within the last 2 years. We could move forward to page 15. This talks about the omnichannel experience. So they've got 359 stores, and they've put a ton of time, money, and effort into the website, which is now functional and works pretty well. I used it around Christmas time. But they want to beef that up substantially, make it a lot more efficient and effective. Yet they think the website with the stores works extremely well because you can go online, buy and reserve a product, and then just go up to the local store and pick it up if there's one in your area. Again, they're in 35 states, and that helps their profitability, because 40 to 50% of their e-commerce is fulfilled in the store. So they have quicker turnaround than if it was shipped out, lower cost, obviously. And also when people come into the store to pick up the item, on average, they spend an additional 20% of that purchase on additional items. Page 20, please. This is what they've done over the last few years to improve infrastructure, and they accelerated the process in 2020 in the COVID environment. They closed 59 underperforming stores. They removed $45 million of operating expenses. They renegotiated virtually all the rents and leases that were up for renewal, and I believe that was the majority of the stores over this couple-year period. And they also closed their centralized e-commerce fulfillment center and opened three smaller hubs to cut delivery time and also costs. We could go to the next page, please. So they're going to continue to rationalize the store base, although it's most of the heavy lifting's been done. In 2019, they had 59 stores that were EBITDA negative. Again, that's before COVID. And their four-wall average EBITDA was $136,000 per store. For the 12 months ending October 2021, they have zero stores with negative EBITDA, and the average is $278,000. So they've dramatically improved the store mix. Over the next 3 to 5 years, they're going to continue to improve the stores. They think they'll exit some stores, perhaps reopen or open new stores in high-performing markets. But as you see on the chart there, they consider 165 of their stores high-performing, 124 mid-performing that need refresh, 52 low-performing with potential for relocation, and I'm sure that's dependent on lease expirations, and then 28 of them they anticipate exiting the market. We could go to page 22, the next page. This talks about the $45 million of operating costs they removed in store payroll. They changed the labor model and reduced operating hours after COVID closures. Corporate, they reduced headcount about 30%, reduced office space, professional fees, and travel, and they now use zero-based review to determine whether other expenses are necessary or not. We could go to page 24. So this is their leadership team. The gentleman on the left, that's Steve Woody Woodward. He's been in senior leadership positions at notable retailers for over 30 years. Prior to coming on as the CEO of Kirkland's, he was the president and chief merchandising officer of Crate & Barrel, which is a top competitor of theirs. So I think he's perfectly suited for the turnaround he's been leading at Kirkland's. If we could go to page 26. So this shows their revenue over the last several years, and the revenue chart from a distance isn't that impressive, but if you consider all the stores they've changed, and if you also look at the orange section of each bar, which shows e-commerce from 2016 to the last 12 months, they've tripled, more than tripled, the share of their revenue coming from e-commerce. And by doing that with substantially fewer stores, you can see on the right-hand side of the chart, their adjusted EBITDA has started to move up pretty dramatically. We could go to the next page. These are their financial targets. In terms of sales growth, they want to get e-commerce growth in the range of 25 to 35% annually, so that e-commerce by 2025 is 50% of revenue. They plan to expand gross margins through these four things: continued discipline evolution of the discount strategy, which is a fancy way of saying lower discounts. You don't attract the customer and just by selling things cheaply. Expand direct sourcing to 70% of purchases by 2025, which will reduce cost of goods sold. Improve the supply chain efficiency, and obviously they've got their work cut out for them, like every retailer, over the next year as the supply chain and freight issues get ironed out, and then leverage occupancy and other fixed costs. And then finally, they want to leverage top-line growth to improve profitability using disciplined cost management while they invest in marketing and technology to support the sales growth, low to mid double-digit annual EBITDA margin by 2023, high single-digit annual operating margin by 2023. And obviously, if you put pencil to paper on those items and work through to the bottom line, you'll have a company with very impressive cash flow and earnings power. And like they did last year, they want to use strong cash flow generation to return excess cash to shareholders. And we've seen this over and over in the retail industry with RH, with sporting goods, these companies that use excess cash flow to buy back stock. Hibbett's is another retailer that does that, and it does wonderful things for their stock price. And then page 28. These are the investment highlights as management sees them. They've got a large and growing market opportunity. Growing because they're moving, again, more into larger items like furniture versus what somebody like me would call more like the knickknacks and so forth of the home decor business. They want to have a differentiated selection of merchandise to fill what they believe is currently white space or unoccupied in the marketplace. They're going to build brand awareness and market share. They're going to drive digital growth and optimize the store footprint to create an omni-channel customer experience. A lot of the things that are online won't be in the stores, but at the same time, the stores, to a degree, will be a showcase of their best-selling and most popular items. Next, have a more efficient operating model to drive higher profitability. And lastly, I think they're in good shape on this one, have a strong management team to execute brand transformation and deliver improved shareholder returns. So that's the opportunity in a nutshell, John. The stock ran from low single digits up to the mid-30s in the last, in the year ending this summer. Since then, it's come back down into the mid-teens. And I think given the strength of the CEO and the plan and the evidences is in what he's already accomplished just thus far, I think over time the stock will get back up into the mid-30s and better as they continue to grow the revenue, grow the earnings, and buy back stock.
Well, terrific. Thank you so much, Pat, for outlining the investment opportunity here. and how you see it. Maybe you could talk a little bit more about the upside to the stock price. How should we think about that?
Well, you know, I think the whole retail area, you know, whether it's Target, and as you get more into segments of retail and less away from the big box, we sell everything retail. I mean, Dick's Sporting Goods, all of the retailers have gotten punished. And it seems like the more specialty they are in general, or the smaller cap they are, like Kirkland's, for instance, versus Dick's, it seems like they've gotten punished even more. So, I mean, in my view, you know, mentally, I've got a $30 18-month target. And depending on how fast they can iron out the supply chain and the freight cost issues, that could well be conservative.
Could you talk a little bit more about the management team, their incentives, and your confidence level in their ability to evolve the business going forward?
Well, I've spoken with them, and I've also exchanged emails with them. They're very incentivized and very motivated to get the stock price up. Steve Woodward, you know, has been a senior executive in successful retailing companies for over 30 years. And I mean, the fact that they were able to attract him from Crate and Barrel, where he was the president and chief merchandising officer, I mean, if this stock performs like Crate and Barrel, I think we'll all be very happy.
And in terms of the key data points here to track the progress of the business, what are you focusing on the most?
I'm focusing on revenue more than anything else, because that'll tell me how they're doing in terms of growing market share, and also in terms of their merchandise migration up that ladder, going from value to quality. And if the transformation also from going to the more traditional into more modern is working. You know, I don't have a great feel for how long it's going to take for all the retailers to work through these supply chain situations we have going on, and how long it's going to take for freight costs to settle back down or to implement that into the selling prices. But, I'm confident they're capable of doing that as well as anyone. So I think since that's somewhat out of their control, I think the best measurement of their success for the time being is going to be, you know, how well can they grow the revenue?
And on the capital allocation front, what would you like to see in terms of the mix there?
I'd love to see them continue to buy back stock, you know, but not to the degree to which it would impede you know, investing in the business. They've said a sizable portion of their stores need to be upgraded. That's obviously a priority. They need to keep investing in IT to get the omnichannel experience where it needs to be. So those are the priorities. But if they continue to run the business as they did just this last year, and they were able to redeem 11% of the outstanding shares last year, I mean, even if they could do just half of that to be conservative on an ongoing basis, the, you know, just like with Apple Computer, the revenue and earnings per share will explode.
Great. Well, Pat, thank you so much for taking the time to be with us. I would just encourage our members to feel free to follow up with you with any further thoughts or questions. I really appreciate you being with us and sharing this investment thesis with our members.
Okay, well, it was my pleasure, John, and good luck to you.
Thank you so much. Goodbye for now.
Goodbye.